I feel like I can't say your name without calling you Artist John Charles, because that's who you are. Thank you so much for joining me today on the podcast. Really appreciate it.
Pleasure. Pleasure to be here.
And we've already kind of pre-framed that nothing is off bounds, out of bounds. It's all conversational. So I'll always start. I'm not a fan of doing a whole CV, and your CV could be War and Peace in terms of what you've experienced, what you've achieved. For those who don't yet know who you are, how would you describe the John Charles we see today?
Well, the little nickname that I've seen sort of gathered recently over the past year or two is the Scouse Van Gogh.
Yes, I love it.
And that, I feel like, is what I'm being a lot more known for, is for my artwork now. Mm-hmm. But it also, I'm known for my recovery. So recovery and art comes together for me. Yeah.
And that's definitely something that we're going to venture into both of them. I think who we start out is who we, you know, either veer towards more of or move away from. So a reason that you've mentioned recovery, you know, you have been through some massive highs and lows. If we kind of start, because art became a real big part of your life kind of early on towards yeah. tail end of school.
Yeah.
So you grew up in a normal family, nice yep. family.
Yeah, yeah.
Normal upbringing.
Yeah, my mum was a manager in William Hill Betting Shop. My dad worked for Ford's pretty much most of his life until he retired. Brother and sister. My auntie who lived with us, she's mentally handicapped, disabled. It was a normal, happy, just an easy life. We yep. wasn't rich, we wasn't poor, we was just comfortable. Mm.
Which is sometimes a challenge.
Yeah, it's right.
Do you think
in the middle.
You created your own kind of, because I always talk about people, we all live in our comfort zone. If we live in our comfort zone, it's the danger zone.
Yeah.
Because we're either moving away from a pain or moving towards a pleasure. Do you think you created the pain unintentionally?
Oh, do you mean the pain as in the addiction side of things?
Yeah, because that started at a very young age, didn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, I don't know where that come from, like, because I seen my dad drunk once in his entire life. I've never seen my mum drunk. Mm. I've seen him drink, but I've never seen him drunk.
Yeah.
They've never smoked, they've never taken drugs. So I've never, ever been privy to any of that. And I remember being like dead against it. I remember being in seniors and hearing that people had snorted cocaine. I was like, whoa, that's fucked up, that. But then when I left school, I had not my first drink, I had a drink. And that was kind of like, it was just took me. It just gripped me. Yeah. And I don't feel like it was anything to do with like childhood traumas or anything like that. I do believe like you can have, it's a disease of your body.
Yeah.
I'm a firm believer in that. So once I started it, there was just no stopping it.
And I think this is really important as well that we touch upon it, because we see the person before us today who's like just making waves in the world of art. And I'm not a massive art lover or fan. I came across you because I know Paul Smith, and I'd seen that you'd done some for him and yeah. some for Laurie, and just loved. I think your art is one of those that I think anyone can appreciate.
I like that.
It's for everyone. That's the impression that I got. And so then I just kind of delved into it. I started realizing, you know, little bits about you, and I was gripped by it, that you are the, I don't know, I just think you're everyone's artist, in that you, people can relate to you. You know, obviously I'm from Liverpool, there was that connection immediately, and there's all of these stereotypes that I'm trying to break the mold of, you know. I think you may have fallen into that, you know, where people go, oh, Scousers, yeah, having a drink in the park. Yeah. Of course he's going to go out, he's going to be doing this, he's been doing that. But the reality is, you weren't running away from anything, you had a nice upbringing.
Yeah.
Do you think you've got an addictive personality?
Oh, ridiculously yeah. addictive personality.
It's good or bad?
It can go both ways. Like, it can happen with food now. Yeah. Like, that's another, like, issue that can sometimes creep up on me. Yeah. But that first day that I took cocaine was, like, the biggest thing that ever took hold. And I remember it. I remember exactly, I was on the high street, and one of the lads we were out with, he gave me a tiny little key of cocaine, and I was bladdered, and he just pulled it, and I went, and I remember just being like, whoa, that was it.
So
like,
vivid.
It was like, boom, it took everything. My whole body was like, yes. And then I loved everybody for the entire night. I'm telling
everyone's
everyone,
mate.
I love them, I love them. But within about 6 to 12 months, it went from that little key to the fact that I couldn't then go out unless I'd spent like maybe I got £200 that I'd spend a night just on cocaine. That was rapid within 12 months. Yeah. Over the years, it just progressed and progressed and progressed. I remember like one of the final binges was around about £3,000 over a weekend. It could have been more than that because I think I'd been on my own for a day before another friend came round. And we didn't, like, it was never, it wasn't a party lifestyle. It was telly on mute, just sit and pass the tray kind of thing for 3 days.
And this obviously is just, so we've just been speaking, it's almost 13 years clean and sober. We definitely need to touch upon that because there are these stereotypes of like, oh, they fell in with a bad crowd or, you know, yours was a mate on a night out.
Yeah.
How old were you?
16.
So from 16, having this upbringing, because you'd been into art since then. I know you always give huge amounts of credit to your teacher and I love that. So art's always been a passion?
Yeah. I mean, from when I was a kid, I was always drawing. I'd always, like, one of my biggest presents would be like a massive A1 pad of paper and I'd just be given a few markers and I would just sit and I would draw and I'd cover every single piece of that paper.
Yeah.
Then I'd be on to the next page. And that was, I can't remember, like, as far as, as long as back as my memory goes, I was always drawing. But when I was, I think like 10, when I'm my last year in primary school, was when I met my teacher, who was then called Miss Lomax. She's now Mrs. Willis. And we're still in contact. She came to see me just before Christmas. Or was it? No, in fact, it might have even been after Christmas. Oh, it was in the past few months anyway.
Yeah.
And she was just like the most excitable teacher ever. She was, everything was just, every day was like, what are we doing today in school? And she was an amazing artist. She still is. And she just made the love for art for me. It was, she just showed me all kinds of different things and the love was there and that was it then. So when I went into senior school, if I'm honest, I didn't really listen to anything my senior school teacher taught, like tried to, my art teacher, and this might sound cocky, but it was, he didn't really teach me anything.
Mm-hmm.
They just spoke at me. In the end, I would just create my own thing to the point where when it got to like GCSE year, I was like, listen, I don't want to do languages. Can I stop? And they were like, yeah. So I pulled out of languages. I pulled out of religious education. They're like, well, what are you going to do? The school was letting me do this.
Yeah.
And I was like, I'll just do art. And they're like, well, you can't go in the class because he'll have another. I was like, I'll sit outside because there's a huge table outside.
So this is while, so you were studying art as your subject matter.
Yeah.
You basically dropped out of the ones that you weren't enjoying, but instead of forcing you into another subject.
They let me just go just and sit outside the art class and just create.
Now there are going to be some people who go, oh, that's the worst thing in the world. And when you said this might sound cocky, like I am all for it. I've got a 10-year-old and a 13-year-old. 13, he's going to kill me for mentioning any of this, but you know, what he doesn't know won't hurt him. Yesterday he came home with his options. And we'd spent a lot of time beforehand discussing it. We'd been to industry day. We'd look through what he wants to do, trying to reverse engineer. You know, he wants to go into business. And some of his teachers in school and the parents evening, and this is what I love about your teachers in that school, which I think is the right way of doing it personally, is that they'd said, you know, what does he want to do? Blah, blah, blah. What do you want to study? And he was debating whether to study business studies.
Yeah.
Now, unbeknownst to the teachers, he sat in the house with me and gone, Mum, my business studies teacher, you know, doesn't have businesses. He teaches business studies. He hasn't got the type of car that I want. That's not quite how he said it. He said he's got a Honda Civic. What can he teach me? And I'm like, there is a bit of you that goes, oh, but he was like, well, if he's going to teach me about business and he doesn't run a business, I'll learn more from you and Dad because we run businesses.
Yes.
He then made these decisions on what he was going to study and yesterday came home so disheartened because he was told, you're one of the smartest, you've been picked out first, you must choose a language. And I have a big issue with that. I studied languages. I was the goody two shoes at school. I studied what I was interested in. And I'd said to him, if you're going to be a doctor, you have to study the subject. If not, choose something you're good at or you enjoy.
Yeah.
So I love the fact that your teachers, which may have been, you know, he's not going to listen anyway, let's just leave him to it. But actually that created this safe space for you to just really be a part of it. And we could call art an addiction. If you had a blank piece of paper and you would just fill the entire paper.
Mm-hmm.
So this created this fire inside of you. Did you then always want to be an artist as the job?
No.
It's just a hobby.
I was never, ever backed to do anything with art. And like, I don't even mind saying, like, family and friends, not one person said to me, you could make money from this.
Yeah.
So when I left at school at 15, the next day I was working straight away. I was working behind a bar at Wembley, illegally.
Yes, you do.
Now, I never drew again. I never created again. From once I started
Wow.
15, school finished, drink took over, then drugs took over. So I never done anything again after that.
Yeah.
Until I was 27. That's when I started again.
And that's, so do you think you replaced one addiction with another? It was like, that's the thing. Because I believe I've got an addictive personality when you'd said about, you know, it could be food or it could be exercise. It's one extreme or the other. I'll double down on things. And because yeah. you were doing that in art and then obviously weren't backed, imagine how your life would have been if that would have been the route. That being said, the person
I feel
we
like
see,
it's probably, this conversation wouldn't be happening.
Yeah, absolutely.
People might not be as interested. Oh, he's just another artist. But like, because of what's gone on, people are a little bit more interested in finding out your story, Andy. So I wouldn't, people say, would you go back and change anything? I'm like, no. Mm. I've put people through heartbreak and pain and stuff, but I've made amends for all of that as well. Yeah. And I wouldn't be who I am if it weren't for that. I know that sounds a little bit cliche or whatever, but it's true.
I'm all about the woo-woo in that respect. Yeah. I used to be the least like spiritual or ethereal person, but you know, and when people say, when you're going through dark times and people say everything happens for a reason, it's hard to understand that when you're facing challenges or adversity. But actually it took you on this different path. Age of 15, working in bars, which obviously exacerbated the problem because you didn't just, you know, dabble a little bit in, you know, testing this on a night out or testing that, to go from that into such a short space of time.
Yeah.
How did you fund it? Because you were working in, you know, office jobs or, you know, well, working in bars.
I had no responsibilities at That's all. True. So I could quite easily, I'd get my whole wage, that'd be mine. Then when I was working, bear in mind, the first 12 months wasn't, anybody could have sustained that as an addiction because it wasn't that much money really. But once it ramped up, I had an office job. I was a civil servant. I was also working on the doors as well. So I'd be a bouncer and that would be like 5 to 6 nights a week. I'd have to do that
just to
be able to fund me addiction. Quite often it would be, here's your wages, who do you know?
Oh my God.
Take it out, pass it on. And majority of the time I might not even come home with any money because I'd owe it all out.
But that was normal.
Yeah. But then payday loans came in then, didn't they? And that was like payday loan. And I'd just keep ramping them up. That's how I funded it in the end. It got to a point where me and my wife, we had a house together and we went through a bit of a breakup at one point, rightfully so. And I think I'd missed the mortgage for 3 months. So it was getting to a point where, oh, she didn't know any of this.
She was oblivious to it all.
Because I was that, but I was having to use the money elsewhere. So that's how I funded it. But I did work. I've always worked. Like even when I was a kid, I had a paper round.
Yeah.
So I've never not worked kind of thing anyway. So even with my addiction, I'd work the office 5 days a week and I'd work the doors 5 or 6 nights a week.
So you were such a functioning addict because it was both drink and, you know, predominantly coke.
Yeah.
Like
in the end, it was more just the coke though. It got to a point where I would just dry sniff.
Oh my God.
I would prefer to just snort than drink in the end. So.
And sitting on your own?
Oh, yeah. I'd never be around people. I couldn't. If I went
so
out
this
for
wasn't
a night
social
out,
thing?
Nah. At the beginning it was. It was all like I said, I loved everyone. But in the end, it honestly, it gripped me so quick. And I remember being in the office one day and I think I've said this on the documentary. I have like a little calendar on my desk and I thought, let's just mark the days when you've snorted with an orange highlight. I remember it being orange. And then I remember looking back, I was like, fuck me.
It's all orange.
It's a lot of orange going on here. And that was around, I think I might have been about 20, 21 at that point.
So subconsciously you knew you had a problem.
There was something going wrong. And that's when I ran off to Kenya.
So this is a really unique story. Because you've obviously got a documentary, we'll put links in the comment section for all of this. But I've listened to podcasts, I've watched it, and I'm like, hang on a minute. Fully functioning addict, funding your habit quite comfortably by that point because you've got no responsibilities. Yeah. You've got, you know, you didn't have your daughter then, you didn't have all of these responsibilities. And then one day the switch is flicked and you go, that's it, I'm fucking off to Kenya. I'm going to go and help other people. Like, where did that decision come from?
So I've always, because like with my auntie, I'll just jump back to my auntie who lived with us since when my mum and dad were 21. My nan and granddad couldn't look after my auntie. She's mentally, physically disabled. So they took her on and they were full-time carers. So when I was born, I was just brought up with my auntie, so I cared for her all the time. And that just seemed to be something natural for me. Like, I loved helping and caring and looking after other people. And then it got to the point where, obviously, things weren't going right in my life. Nobody knew there was any issues, though. People just thought I was just going to Kenya. But I was trying to run away from what was a problem back here. And I just went on the internet, Googled, found a place, and I was like, fuck it, bump. Paid for a ticket, booked me flights. And within, I think, 4 weeks from deciding, I was gone.
And were you with your now wife then, girlfriend?
We was just dating at that point. So I was like, listen, I'm going.
Do you think you were, like, looking back now, do you think you were probably trying to stop her from getting too involved? Like, if I run away now, were you not aware of it?
I just needed to, it was kind of like, I'm still like a little bit like this now where I'll have an idea and I'm like, fucking, I'm doing this.
Oh my God, my husband's going to listen to this and be like, he's the male you, which is a real challenge for people, especially if they're more grounded and more, you know, let's just have a think about it first, idea and run with it.
Something that I've said recently where it is, I never ever feel like I'm at home or home, no matter where I am. So like, you could move me to my dream house on a farm with animals and fruit and veg, and I probably still wouldn't feel at home. So I feel like this is something that's always been there. So the Kenya thing was like, right, let's go.
Always trying to fill a void.
Yeah. And I still don't know what the void is, but I'm trying to learn now.
Yeah.
And I feel like it's more about, I've been listening to an audio book, The Four Agreements and The Fifth Agreement as well. And I feel like that's starting to make me understand a little bit more. But yeah, so Kenya happened and I just belted off to Kenya. So there was obviously no drugs there. But after about a month, I was drinking. And there was like this little hotel, which was not really a hotel. It was just like a concrete building.
Little hovel.
And you could get like a big, massive bottle of beer for about 35p. So it was easy. And I would easily drink 10 of them a day. I'd just be like...
Day to night, not just a social thing again.
At the beginning, we were like, it was all out, do the work of the families. And then, but then it got to a point where, like, if we'd finished in the afternoon, let's just go there and have a drink, or let's get some drinks and bring them back to the compound with us. So I didn't get to run away from it. And this is why I always say to people with addiction, you can't run away from it. You could go anywhere in the world. If it's strong enough, you'll find a way.
And so you were in Kenya for how long?
Just over three months.
So you run away for 3 months, found something else to substitute it.
Yeah.
When you came back, was it immediately like, I've missed it? Did you just have a complete blowout?
It was within days. Really? I was back on it. Yeah, within days. But then I had an excuse, because people seeing that I was like going off the rails a little bit, like, oh, but he's been through a lot in Kenya, hasn't he? Like, yeah.
So they were actually enabling you.
Without them knowing.
Yeah.
I'm like, yeah. Because don't get me wrong, the things that I seen over there was horrific.
Yeah.
But it was never a reason to go back and snort. It was an excuse, is what it was.
But at the time, it was a reason, and you could justify it to yourself or to anyone else. Although you didn't really need to justify it to anyone else, because there you are hiding it on your own. Like this, I find this so hard to get my head around, because I'm an all or nothing kind of person in every area of my life. But I'm a social drinker. I think I'm officially classed as a binge drinker. I'll go out one night in a blue moon, get absolutely shit-faced, feel rough for days, and then not touch drink again for ages. Never really been the type of person to sit and drink in the house. So when people do, I'm a bit like, find that a little bit weird, but this is next level. This is consciously making sure no one is around, those closest to you, and just sitting. What was it that you got from it, from sitting there just,
nothing. Like, honest to God, like in the end, it was hell. Like, it was horrific. So in our house that we had first, it was like a 3-story Muse house.
Yeah.
So if I knew Jem was coming home, I would make sure that there was cocaine in the kitchen, cocaine in one of the bedrooms, and cocaine in the top bedroom.
My God.
So that whatever floor she was on, I could get to something at that point. It wasn't 7 days a week. It might be 3, 4, 5 days a week.
Which therefore made it justifiable for you, because it's all right, you don't need it every day.
But if I could have got it and I could have afforded it every day, I would have. But yeah, that was like, it was always present, it was always available for me in a way. And people like me are a drug dealer's dream.
Yeah.
Because I would get it on tick, or strap, whatever you want to call it. Because they knew that they'd always get it back somehow.
And you'd do whatever it took. You'd take on a second job. You'd work your socks off.
Yeah.
And so that started 16 and then obviously gradually worsened. You mentioned 27.
Yeah.
What was the turning point? Was it a rock bottom moment? Was it a, you know, wake up realization, an epiphany? Was it someone holding you to account?
There, just off you saying that. The rock bottom, because I know people have took the piss out of me for this before. Other addicts and stuff would be like, oh, that's not a fucking rock bottom, that. Everybody's rock bottom is probably something bottom. Completely different. It didn't mean that I was homeless or I was lying in my own shit and piss or nothing like that. I'd already lost me. Well, she was still my girlfriend at the time, but me and Jen had split up. The baby was born. I was not getting to see her every day. And again, rightfully so, because you wouldn't want a joke of a person around your child the way I was. And I was working on the doors. And at the end of the night, everybody would have like a little half a lager or a bottle of beer or whatever. Yeah. And I asked for a shot of, I don't know if it was Sambuca. I think it was Sambuca or something like that. And I had a shot instead. And the girl behind the bar just went, you're a fucking disgrace, you. And I was like, oh,
I've just got goosebumps.
And that, being him, I'd already snorted about 18 grams of cocaine that night.
Jesus. How are you still standing? Constitution of a horse. Yeah. Do you think that's actually just you've become accustomed to it then? Yeah. It's become a habit.
When I started, it was about this much, but in the end, when I was snorting, you'd be putting like a 20 bag out or a gram for one line kind of thing. That's the only way I'd feel like I had anything. But when she said that to me, it was just like a bolt of lightning. And I was like, shit. I had already dabbled in going to Cocaine Anonymous and Alcoholics Anonymous, but I never ever stuck it down. I'd go in for a couple. And then I'd be like, ah, fuck, that's not me.
Over how long was that? Like
maybe over a year.
Wow, I'd so you
dabbled
knew you
to
had
try
a...
and do yeah. it.
You were looking for help.
Yeah, I'd been dying for help for years before that. But it was literally she said that. And the next day, or on the Monday, I went to a meeting. And I went to the meeting. And rather than just going to the meeting, I went to the meeting. I was like, can I get a sponsor? Can I start the 12-step program? Let's hammer this 12-step program as fast as I can. The quicker you can get through it, the better.
Wow.
And that was one of the best journeys of my life, being able to do the 12 steps. One of the steps is you write a list of people that you've harmed, not like, it doesn't have to be physical, but, you know, emotional or anything like that. And then you've got to be willing to go and make amends to those people. Not all of those people would be willing to accept the amends. And you have to be like, okay, I've tried, I can bury that now.
Yeah,
that's not part of me anymore. Not one person said no. And I got to go out and apologise to all these people.
Which you make sound really easy, but you know, you've
stop
done...
for a minute there because I got a little bit... But there was one specific person, was a manager who I worked with, and I'd made her life hell for a year. But one of the other managers knew me for a long time, and she was kind of like...
People made excuses.
Say, just keep with him. And being able to apologise to her face to face was just like, whoa.
Yeah, but that takes some guts as well.
We both just sat crying. I made an amends to the police as well. I had to admit to the police officer that I was in the wrong for doing what I'd done to him. Being told, if you make this apology, you are admitting to a crime that you've done. And I was like, I've got to, if that means I have to go to jail now, then that's part of my recovery.
Oh my God. So
the officer agreed for me to write him a letter and for me to pass it on. The letter got passed on. The police came back to me on the doors and said, he accepts your apology. Done.
Wow.
So
this shows the power of addiction in everything, because your addiction obviously created horrific scenarios. You know, you touched upon losing your then girlfriend, who for complete clarity is now John's wife and it's all good. But, you know, there was a massive risk there. That should have been a turning point. You'll have people who say, you know, your gorgeous little baby girl is born.
That should be
a turning point, which is why some people might say it's really weird. But everyone has their turning point. But actually, your addiction, which you'd managed to overcome in there, the addictive personality, meaning I've got to make amends with everyone, despite the fact that must have been the scariest thing in the world, knowing that it could completely change the trajectory.
But you know what? I was at a point where I was like, there's nowhere else to go here. So apologise. Just, and what will be, will be. I mean, it wouldn't have lasted in jail. I'd have been a piece of meat. I'm very well aware of that.
You've got a very pretty face. You would have been
screwed. My pocket would have been out all the time.
Which obviously you can laugh about, but the reality is that was a genuine concern, and things could have gone a completely different way. Do you believe that there is something or someone looking out for you? Do you believe that if you've done enough good in your life that that didn't happen, or was it just sheer luck?
With regards to the police? Or
everything, with being able to walk back into the lives of your now wife and your little girl and being
I feel blessed for it. I still don't understand the whole. I feel like I'm a little bit spiritual, so I do believe that there's someone looking out for me, whether that's a person or just a higher energy.
Yeah.
Like the universe.
It's going to be something.
Kind of thing. Something's there, because I probably shouldn't be alive, or I shouldn't be in the position that I'm in today, which is a very, very blessed position.
Yeah, but you've also worked your socks off for it. You know, it's I always talk about the analogy where people go, this overnight success, but actually you've been grafting in the background.
It pisses me off, honestly.
Good.
It pisses me off because I, over the past couple of years, have started selling paintings for a
considerable amount of money.
A large amount of money, more money than I would have earned in a year in my day job. Now, this will probably annoy a few people because they might watch this, but I get messages. I all of a sudden start to get messages off artists. Can you sell my painting for me? Or how are you selling that? I can't fucking give mine away. And I'm like, do you think that I've just started selling paintings? Because these people might have only been following me for the past year or two. I've been painting since I was 27.
Yeah.
When I was 27, I was selling paintings for £30. That £30 didn't go up very fast.
Yeah.
I went from 30 to 200, I jumped to 250. It was just like a fucker.
A big jump, but still nothing in the grand scheme of things to where you are now.
And then it went from 250. It didn't go to 495 until lockdown. That's when my value went up to 495. Then I had another artist who jumped on board and started to give me a little bit of advice. And I'll say his name, Lincoln Townley. He has been fucking unreal with his advice. I don't know whether or not, I know I wouldn't have took the jumps that I would have took if it wasn't for him. But it's like, he was like, right, double it, put it up to this. And every time I'd done what he said, it came in. But people don't see the fact that I was grafting all these £30 paintings. I was doing tote bags. I was doing anything I could to get my art out there at one point. Now I'm in a blessed position where I can not sit back, because I've got paintings galore that I've never even released. I'm always painting every day or sketching at the very least. But they just see, oh, fucking hell, he's just sold a painting for £20,000 in Dubai there. Can you sell mine? I'm like, fuck me.
Do you know what? I absolutely love this, because the lesson is, and I always talk about the lessons in the podcast. We talk about, you know, what can people learn from it? There's undoubtedly someone who's right at the start of their, I'm just a social drinker, or I'm just a social drug taker, or there's someone who's in the depths of despair. And so these conversations, you know, selfishly for me, I just love having conversations. The fact that I do this, I'm blessed to be able to do this. Getting people's stories out there to different groups and demographics of people as well. Because I think quite often when people are doing the rounds on podcasts or doing social, there's certain types of people who will follow them.
Yeah.
What about those people who need to hear what you've got to say, but also the honesty around it? Because there's so many people who'd be the quickest to knock you down when you're on your way up, but then want to jump on the bandwagon when you're there. And it is very much two fingers to each of those, look at what's been going on in the background. Yeah. So we've got to touch upon, I always flip back and forward because my mind, I've definitely got ADHD undiagnosed. What made you pick up a brush, palette knife, a pencil, whatever, at 27, where was the kind of, you should have been doing it in the grand scheme of things?
Goosebumps again, because I don't even know why I got emotional then.
Fucking hell.
Mainly because, and it's the one person who shouldn't have been there to help me, and it was my wife's dad. I don't even get upset over this.
Get exclusives.
Fucking hell. He is the one person who should have been like, fuck him off. He's a joke. But when I started recovery, I had an operation on my nose because I couldn't breathe. It was fucked. And I was housebound for a few weeks. And he just said, here's some canvases, here's some brushes, here's some paints. do something with your time instead of just, he knew that I was artistic and I was into art. He'd probably never really seen what I could do. And he just gave me some stuff to paint with. And I just sat. So again, it was a little small living room in Widnes. I had a coffee table, smaller than that. I had this tiny little A4 sized easel, and I'd have a little A3 sized canvas that was like out of Home Bargains or somewhere. The brushes will just look like a donkey's tail. They were shite. It was really cheap acrylic paints. And I just started painting some Disney stuff. That's when it started. And I just, I don't know why I put one of them on Facebook. And I wish I wouldn't have closed my old Facebook account now. But I put one of them on Facebook and somebody asked if she could buy it. I was like, buy that? She was like, I was like, how much? And she offered me 30 quid for it. And I was like, sold. That was then when I realised, hang on, I can paint and earn at the same time. And I was in recovery then. So what I earned was our money. It wasn't to pay a debt off. It was like, we can start earning. What I'd done for probably the first year, I lose a bit of track on the timelines, but I just created Disney paintings. Disney's always been like one of my favourites. Winnie the Pooh, I could watch him. I still watch him now. Like Jenna walk in, she's like, you aren't watching Winnie the Pooh? I'm like,
that's what I'm doing.
No one asked. It's just, it makes me feel good. So I started doing Disney paintings, and then somebody said, well, could you put my kid's name on it? And I'm like, Zal. Now I wouldn't dare do that. But I'm like, yeah, Zal. So I put it on. And then they just started selling. So in the end, I'd have like 5 canvases lined up with Mickey Mouse on each one, and then a different kid's name on each one. And then Jen was like, oh, listen, this is getting a little bit bigger than what we thought. This, do you want that spare room? So the Emmy, our daughter, was then big enough to go from the baby's room into her own bedroom. So I got her little bedroom that we then created into a little bit of an art studio, which enabled me to paint a little bit bigger and more kind of mass produce these Disney paintings. Yeah. And that's where it stemmed from then. And then luckily for me, I hadn't found my own style for a while. I was still just replicating and copying everything. And my friend who we were talking about before, David, just before he passed away, he said, you need to go and speak to one of my mates, Danny O'Connor. He said, since we've left school, that's all he's done is art. He said, he makes a living selling paintings. I'm like, fuck off.
Was that like a light bulb for you? That's not possible?
Not right then. At first, I was thinking, I'm not going to go introduce myself to this artist who's absolutely flying. But then Dave passed away and I was like, fuck it. He got me into recovery, by the way.
Wow.
So I was like, I owe him this. So I sent a message over to Danny. He invited me around to his house. He has a studio in there and we painted for the day. I could talk about that all day, but he kind of gave me a new lease of life to not be scared to try new things, be a little bit more explosive and just go for it on the canvas. Don't be scared of a mistake when an art teacher would say, that's not right. It's like, this is what I try to say to anybody who's getting into art now. I'm like, don't let a teacher or anybody say, that's not right. If you want to paint somebody with fucking 7 fingers on one hand, you paint them with 7 fingers on one. Who gives a shit? It's what you see, not what they see kind of thing. Danny lit that little fire inside me. But then after that, for the next 6 to 12 months, every painting I did, there was like glimpses of Danny O'Connor's artwork in there.
It had a bit of an influence,
but like steal his, not, I wouldn't say steal it, but he was,
but that's
he heavily influenced me, do you know what I mean? In the end, I sat back and I'm like, it still doesn't feel like my artwork, this. So I had Disney, then I started doing different stuff like portraits, but there was aspects of Danny's work in there which just didn't feel right.
Yeah.
And then a friend of mine from Ireland, who, I have to say this, she's not from Ireland, she lives in Ireland, she's a Scouser.
She's, yeah, well, you know, all we all take time. That very seriously.
And she sent me a picture of a digital palette knife painting. She's like, do you think you'd be any good at something like this? And I was like, well, I can't do digital work. So I went out and bought a palette knife. That's when things kicked off. Soon as I started doing a palette knife paintings, everyone was like, ooh, I feel like people took me a little bit more serious then. It was like, because it was a style that nobody else had seen.
Yeah.
And my style just
evolved
from there. And it's still evolving now. Every painting I do, there's always going to be something a little bit new that I might just try and put something in there or whatever. But that was how it evolved quite quickly, I think.
Yeah. What I absolutely love about this, and something that I think is plays a big part in people following you and liking you, is that I believe that people buy into people. They probably, some people will see your art and just buy that and then fall in love with you as the artist. Some people will follow you and then become a fan of art off the back of it. I'm a big believer in people by people, but the thread that I can see here is every bit of that is gratitude to other people, to your father-in-law for handing you the, you know, the easel and the things that you never would have used today, but it was the starting point. It was the gratitude to your friend who then went, it wasn't anything commissioned. It was, you've done that, can I buy it? And they put a value on it. I deal in sales and speaking and I teach people how to sell, etc. And perceived value is key, and someone saw it in something that you did. Mass production then, but still never feeling at home. Yeah. Then doing obviously, and the introductions, you know, the gratitude to David for introducing you, the gratitude to Danny for showing you the way. And I think that's what's making so many people fall in love with either you as the individual or you as the artist or the art that you produce, because that shows through. You take your time over it, etc. What I really want to know is, you know, from your, this being your studio, a coffee table, through to the spare bedroom, through to where you are today, what does, you know, being in front of a canvas do for you? What emotions do you feel? Do you go in there with a plan? Are you expressing yourself and it's an idea? Does the name come first or the art come first? I'm fascinated by it.
It's quite a broad question.
It's a big question.
Sometimes I do need to have a plan because I won't be able to sleep if I don't think, right, Monday, we need to start this, prep this canvas, ready to do this on it. So there is an element of, I have to plan certain things. Some of my greatest work is just completely off the cuff. Recently, I was just about to walk out of the studio and a few people had messaged that you're going to do a Jürgen Klopp painting. And I just looked and I had a canvas prepped for something else. And I was like, fuck it. So I just walked back in, mixed a few paints up, started doing a Klopp painting. And I did just the brush stage of it. It took me about an hour and a half, 2 hours. And I was like, oh shit, that's good, that. That was just like, bam, one of those ideas where I wouldn't have slept that night. And in the end, we've sold the painting. We sold all 50 limited edition prints. We sold all 25 large prints. It was just a complete collection sale just from that one spirit of the moment thing.
When you were leaving the studio.
Yeah. But then at the same time, in that question was, when I'm in front of a canvas, this is what I love. Now, it's not always like this, because sometimes I can be really, really thinking about what I'm painting and my head hurts, I'm thinking about what I'm painting, but vast majority of the time is nothing.
Just there's complete freedom.
Nothing. I'm literally just painting and painting. I don't listen to music anymore. I listen to audio books but I won't really be listening to them.
It's just in the background.
They're just there. So it's somebody else talking at me, so I don't talk to myself, because otherwise my head will just take over and I'll create scenarios and I'll go off in places and I could end up being angry off making something up in my own head.
I've had many an argument in my own head.
Silence isn't good for me.
Yeah.
Music, I don't believe, is good for me, because whatever I'm listening to can send me emotions all over the place. I could listen to a sad song and I would genuinely be like depressed. And outside, we're like, what the fuck's happened to him for days? So I choose not to really listen to music anymore, just listen to audio books and podcasts.
Yeah.
But when I'm painting, I feel like most people, maybe if spiritual people might understand a little bit more, is you just want to get to this point where you're just there, like in that moment, there's nothing else. I feel like I might have described this before, where I'm not a dad anymore. I'm not a husband. I'm not a friend. I'm not a son. I'm not an artist. I'm nothing. I am literally just there painting. And there's no feeling in me whatsoever. And a lot of the time then I'll step back and I'll go, fucking hell.
Like you've been in a bit of a trance.
Where have you just done that? And I'm like, that's amazing. I say to myself now, you fucking painted that. What's that? But for the time that I'm doing it, there's just nothing there. And I feel like if I could achieve that nothing in life outside the studio, I feel like life would be a lot happier.
Wow.
I feel like that's what I am aiming for, to be able to just sit and maybe have a cup of coffee, but feel nothing, if that makes sense. I don't know.
It absolutely does. And the fact that you are, that's probably where the, you know, the gold really, no pun intended, we'll get to the gold in a bit. But, you know, that really comes out, the ability to be completely free. Is there any correlation? Because my mind kind of goes, any correlation between that's what you were chasing when you were 18 grams in and however many thousands of pounds chasing that, you get it there. Do you feel like you've replicated that with art?
Are you talking about the lines or?
No, we'll get to the lines in a bit. Hang fire. No, I mean that feeling, because you were saying, you know, the first time that you tried it, the smallest amount, it made you love everyone. It made you feel, you know, you were chasing something, which then led to more and more and more. You needed that substance all of the time. Do you feel like that's a, you're always chasing something? You've said you're feeling a void.
Oh God, yeah, I'm always.
Is that what you're doing with art? Has art been the, you know, you've replicated or you've at least replaced the chasing something with the standing in front of a canvas?
I think so, to a certain point. I mean, what I don't want to do is I want to be able to enjoy my art as well. So I set myself like some crazy goals and I can get a little bit tied up in them.
Yeah.
Like, obsessed. Oh, you haven't achieved that or whatever. But what I'm trying to do now is just think, mate, 5 years ago, you're making £250 a painting. Mm. Now it's like 5, 10, 15, 20,000 pounds a painting. So it's, I don't want to always chase things, yeah, but I don't know.
Like the when's enough enough.
Yeah, I don't think I'll never ever stop painting. Mm. I don't know who this quote was by, but I seen it once and it was, artists don't retire, they simply die. That's it for me. I've gotten, this might sound controversial, not that I've got nothing else. I can't really offer anything else in life apart from my artwork. So I feel like I have to paint. No, I just will paint,
yeah,
as long as I possibly can, because without it, I don't know what I would do. Like, there's nothing else I'm good at. I'm shit at footy. I can lift weights, but even that, I'm like, I'm an average person when I'm in the gym. Like,
it's your genius.
Art is just my thing. I've got nothing else outside of that. I feel like I can speak to people better via my art than actually verbally speaking to people. So that's why I paint certain things to kind of like pass me message on that way.
And that's why sometimes it's that the idea comes, sometimes it's, you know, it's commissioned, sometimes it's, I just had this spark of an idea, yeah, and I had to do it.
I don't take on a lot of commissions anymore, yeah, either. Like in the past, I would take on, if somebody asked me to paint the dog's ass, I'd paint it. I'd paint anything I possibly, because I got told you never know when your next commission's going to come, yeah, so always accept them. But I'm at a point now where, like, if somebody asked me to do a family portrait, I just outright say no, it's, yeah, not for me that. I don't really do pet portraits or anything like that, but I am working on a pet portrait now for, but this is like a 5 foot by 5 foot painting.
It's a hefty picture.
But it's, I become like, not best friends, but good friends with Costa Simicus, who plays for Liverpool. And his wife, and their love for their dogs is just incredible.
So it wasn't the request of a, I want this done, it was the emotion that you connected with.
Yeah, and then when they've talked to me about commissioning me to do this painting of the dogs, I was like, do you know what, I will, I'll do that.
What a lovely position to be in, to have the choice to say yes or no to, yeah, things.
I feel like that's what I wanted to get to, a certain point where I just create what I want to create. Like I always say to everybody, I'll paint what the fuck I want.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people will just paint portraits. A lot of people will just paint animals.
Like pigeonholes.
Or houses. And I will never, ever do that. If I want to paint an animal, a gorilla, a lion, I want to paint a building, an icon portrait, anything, I'll just paint it.
But there's been no compromise.
Yeah.
Has there ever been any pushback because you didn't take the, you know, the typical route that many artists do of studying art, of going to, you know, art school, etc. Yours came a different avenue. Have you ever had any pushback from anyone in the art world that like, that wasn't the normal way to go, or I've done this, you know, and the jealousy, I suppose, is there?
I've never met anybody who's verbally said anything to me.
That's probably because you're not big enough to deck them.
I mean, I was always worried, like, oh, trying to get into galleries and stuff like that. But never. Now I'm kind of like, I don't need a gallery to represent me, because I've sold one painting via a gallery in my whole, since I've been painting. And that was over in Dubai.
Yeah.
I thought it was a £10,000 painting. I ended up with about 1,700 quid out of that.
Because the gallery took their split and then someone else's split.
60%, and then there was like some other extra fees on top of that. that was the only painting that I ever really sold. I have sold another painting via a gallery, but I'd already sold that painting prior to the gallery kind of thing.
Yeah.
So everything I've done has been without the norm of the art world. Like, I'm not a, I can't have like fine art PhD or whatever you want to put next to your name. I've never been taught how to paint. So I'm not, it just doesn't fit well with me. But what I like to say as well is that if you come to one of my exhibitions, you're not coming to a normal art exhibition. I don't want to see people stood there with a glass of fucking red wine swirling it. I'm like, oh, you see that drip? That means that's part of his recovery and that's an emotion. Fuck off, love. That dripped because it was wet. Do you know what I mean? It's like, that's what that is.
I love it.
I hate all that shit. So like,
You've removed the pretension from it.
Yeah, I've people never say been to me, into like, art. What have we got to wear? And I'm like, whatever you want. Yeah. I'm wearing a vest or a jersey and shorts and my sliders. That's what I'm wearing. I had my exhibition in Dubai. I wore a pair of Brooklyn Nets shorts, a pink Nike top with a, it was like a cow print jacket. And then I came in on a little tiny remote control Lamborghini on the floor. Like, and I'm like, zero, just wear whatever you want.
I think that's what makes you such a, and maybe your mom, maybe there's people in the art world who kind of go, that's not what we do. But then you found your people and, you know.
It is, then they haven't told me and I'd be interested in, but in fact, no wouldn't because I don't care.
Yeah, I'm
trying to get to a point where I'm like, I don't care what people think.
This is me, take me or leave me.
Do you know what I mean? It's like, yeah.
But I also think that's what's attracting such a diverse, you know, I'm not into art. I'll never profess to being an expert in any way, shape or form. And I've always felt like there's these kind of barriers and I'm like, I like what I like. And I think that you open that door for people to kind of go, love this, don't like this, because you've got a very unique style.
Yeah.
You spoke about going from the, you know, commissions and the Disney prints and the copying other people's work or the being influenced by other people's work. And then this led into what we see now, which is, you know, your art is so unique. It's so easily recognizable. And the gold lines, I wasn't referring to that before, but you must have been asked that before. Are your gold lines for the palette, you know?
Are they knife, replacing are they, the white lines that you snorted? I'm just going to say, I genuinely don't idea. Know. They literally, I think there was white lines before.
Yeah.
And then I done one painting in golden lines. And I was like, just oozed more class. The white lines, when I used them, made some images look a little bit cartoonish. The golden lines just came. It was just another part of the evolution of my work. It was fluke or something deep
divine
in
intervention,
head.
Whatever it was, know, it happened.
It's there. And now I can't really do a painting without them.
Yeah. I love the fact that what you're doing is carving your own path. You know, I'm not going to go down the gallery route. I want an exhibition. It's going to be my exhibition. Heart on your sleeve, you wear, you know. All of, there must have been a million emotions when you started doing your own exhibitions.
Yeah.
Was there a fear that, like, what if people don't show up?
Oh, my
what?
God. Yeah.
Huge.
So I'd done a couple of open exhibitions at first. So anybody who doesn't know what an open exhibition is, you have to submit an image of your work, pay £25, £35. You then get judged by a panel of three or four, no offence, but usually old as fuck who just like what they like. Yeah. And they'll say yes or no. Been given a no once, and I've always vowed in my head I'll go back to this exhibition one day and get a yes, but then I'm like, I don't need to.
Don't need redemption.
Don't need to. That's gone. I forgive them for their opinion. So I've done a few opens, and then I thought, fuck this. I mean, I like sharing it with others, but I thought, I want it all about me for my exhibition now. And I got my first exhibition. I can't remember what date it was now. It was 2019, 2020. And it was in St. Helens in the World of Glass. And I remember that night, I'd put it out there. I'd asked for people to come and told people to turn up at this time. And rather than having like your typical wine and stuff, I hired this coffee van, Boss coffee van, to come outside, made sure there was all like pastries and free coffee and tea. I think it was about £500-600 for everybody who came. So that was out.
Your
so
exhibition it was on a little your bit terms. Different.
But I remember standing up the stairs thinking, shit, no one's coming here. I'm going to look like a dickhead.
Oh.
The next thing, boom, people just poured in. I think there was 300 people turned up to that exhibition. God. And they said that that was their biggest attendance they've had for a solo exhibition ever.
You must have been like internally thinking,
oh man,
you know, going from absolutely shitting yourself to look, was that like a fire inside of you to kind of go, this is just the beginning?
It was amazing. And here's another thing as well. So any artists out there who might be thinking about having exhibitions and stuff, I think at that first exhibition, I sold 2 paintings out of all 30.
But it was the promo.
It was kind of heartbreaking. I'm like, why the fuck's nobody bought a painting? I think I'm sure it was 2. I could have just crumbled after that.
Mm.
Most of those paintings are then sold on at another date.
Yeah.
Because I always believe every painting has got its own time for when it'll sell.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, I sold a painting the other week, which was exhibited in one of my first exhibitions in 2015. So one of the first open exhibitions I went in, that painting sold the other day for £2,500.
That was its time.
It's nearly 10 years on.
Oh my God.
And it sold. So I always believed they've got the time when they're going to sell. But yeah, the exhibition was, it was like, whoa. And then I got another one. Bear in mind, all my exhibitions as well, I fund myself.
Yep.
So you would get some people who can go and get an art grant for, even like the stretcher bars for the paintings and stuff like that.
Oh, you can't tell the story about the stretcher bars.
Oh, fucking hell. So this was the, so anyone who's listening now or watching, stretcher bars, so you've got a painting. What I do with mine is I have a piece of canvas and I staple it to the wall. I do my painting, then I take it off and I roll it up. And then when it's going to be getting sold or getting displayed, you buy stretcher bars. So it's like a wooden frame, but they come in 2s. So you'd have, my paintings are say 36 by 36. So I would have to get 2 sets,
yeah,
which would make 4 pieces of wood to make a square. When I turned around to my wife and I said to her, I can't remember the exact figures here. I think I'd said to her a number, but she used a 5-bar gate instead, or vice versa. Can you remember what it was?
She used a 5-bar gate, you gave a number.
Yes. So when she then went to the art shop and gave them this piece of paper. It was a hell of a lot more than what I'd all. I stood there and I seen, when I went to pick the stuff up, I was like, fuck me, that's a lot of wood, that. And I look, and he gave me the bill and I was like, £900.
And it should have been how much?
Like, about 2. And I just looked and I thought, I don't like money like that way. So Phil was like, it's a big order, this, John. I'm so grateful for this. I'm thinking,
were you on the inside thinking it shouldn't have been a big order?
Me, mate, I weren't expecting that. Anyway,
did you question it?
No,
you just paid it.
I just paid it. I felt dead bad because he'd put it all together and he was dead excited for making like one of the biggest sales of the year, probably. And then I got it home and I was like, Jen, what the fuck have you ordered here, love? And that's when we realised where she used the 5-bar gate.
So she'd done 1-1, which was 11 instead
which
of
meant
the
2.
2.
1-1 would have meant
2.
To her, it would have meant 2. But to the gallery, that meant 11 sets of 2. So where I wanted 4, I got 24, and that was only in one size. They was all different sizes.
Oh my God.
Honestly, she's 5-bar.
Do you still have some of these?
Well, I think Jen's mum and dad have still got a load of it, and my mum and dad have got a load of them as well. But the smaller ones, I don't really paint in that size anymore. So they were kind of wasted. But yeah, always be careful with your stretcher bars.
We had to touch upon that because I just think that's like, it's easy to laugh and look back now, but at that point you're self-funding everything.
Oh,
so you're buying all of these. You've got no one giving you grants. You know, I'm a believer that what you put out comes back, you know. It could have very easily fallen flat on its face, but that's actually made you make a success of it. There's no one backing you. You've got to back yourself. And I think sometimes you have to rely on just you to back yourself. You've obviously got a great support network
around
you.
Maybe check my orders as well. Now.
Yeah, we don't need to order any of them. We've got some in your mum's house. But then that's led to you doing things on your terms.
Yeah.
So we have to touch upon the fact that you have an upcoming exhibition.
Yes. So the next exhibition I feel like it could be my most proudest one. I had an exhibition a while back called Women, and I got 11 women to come to a studio, an hour slot each, and they posed nude. We got photographs, and then I went away and created the collection of all these women, faceless, yep. So, you know, but it was all like different styles. Like there was a lady who had a...
like the ileostomy bag.
What's it called? Yeah.
Stoma.
Stoma bag. We had ladies who had breast cancer. We had all different shapes and sizes. That was an incredible exhibition. Yeah. But at that exhibition, I met another artist and I said to her, I'm going to put an exhibition on where it's me and I want to invite other artists. And she was like, that sounds amazing. I didn't get to do it the year after, but yeah, I planned it. So when I came back from Dubai, I was thinking, right, we need another exhibition here. So I have arranged with Blackstock Market. So they're the owners of the Hot Water Comedy. So Paul, Blair and Binti. I went and had a little chat with them and I was like, can I have an exhibition in your new venue? This venue is phenomenal. And they were like, oh, this is completely different. Never had this before. What's your plan? So I was like, rather than it just be about me, I've had an amazing couple of years. I've had amazing 10 years, to be honest, but the past 2 to 3 have been way above expectations. And again, like with recovery, it's nice to give back and help others a little bit. So the exhibition's called Artist John Charles and Friends Phono. The phono means for one night only.
Yep.
I robbed that off Ed Sheeran. Because I just thought...
Leverage him.
Algorithms and all that, it might work a little bit. People searching for him might bring ours up.
Got to do what you got to do.
So put that together and they were like, okay, so what are you going to do with it? I was like, so I'll have 6 paintings and then I'm going to invite 6 other artists who've never exhibited before and let them exhibit one piece each. And they were like, sounds great. So I didn't just want to put it out there and be like, who wants to do this? I thought, I like what I like and I've met a couple of people or a few people who I just have really taken to and I've seen their art grow over the past few years. So I just reached out to each one of them and I was like, do you want to be a part of this? And they were like, yeah.
Everyone said yes. Yeah.
Every one of them did. One of them is a girl called Neon. Now it was a chance meeting. I was in town. I was outside a gallery. We were both waiting to go in as it was shut and we just got talking and I had a painting with me and she was like, oh, and she showed interest in that. And one of her main things is photography. Mm-hmm. So she started showing me a photography page. Then I noticed a couple of paintings and I was like, oh my God. She was just one of these people who when you're around, you just feel like
she's a radiator. Invincible.
She was just a lovely person to be around. So then I asked, she's in maybe a last year of uni, going into a last year of uni. So I asked her, and she was like, yes. Wow. So I had 5 people then. I'd given a talk in my daughter's school once before to the 6 formers, just basically what we're talking about, drink, drugs, recovery, art, business. So I went to the school and I was like, have you got any 6 formers who, one in particular, who would like to be a part of this exhibition? Because imagine being 17 and getting the chance to exhibit. I was 27 before I picked up a paintbrush.
Yeah.
I don't know how many years on after that. It wasn't until I got to exhibit my work. But I was like, imagine being 17 and getting that feel for it. Mm. Anyway, they put me in touch with a girl and I went round and I sat with her and a mum and we had a chat for a few hours and this girl is phenomenal, lovely. What she does and creates is just, I love it. Wow. So we ended up with 6 people. And that is what's going on next. So it's on the 23rd of May, Blackstock Market, 6 o'clock until 8 o'clock, but they've said that it's 8 o'clock doesn't have to stop there. So far, we've got rid of 450 tickets.
My God.
The tickets are for free, by the way. It's just so we can keep a
tally on how many.
Yeah, on how many people are going to turn up. I'm not expecting all 450 to turn up. People, things come up, don't they, or whatever, so they might not be able to
make it. Sometimes people say yes and they have no intention. Yeah. Everything in life is just as easy not to do as it is to do.
But I feel like we've got people who have booked hotels to come up from down south. We've got people coming from Scotland, all over, are coming for this exhibition.
How does that make you feel?
Oh, I love it. It's, for me, one of the things that I've said to these other artists who are involved is what an exhibition gives you the chance to do is to thank people face to face, shake their hand, give them a hug. I'm a big hugger. People who don't like hugs don't want to be around me because I'm like straight on it.
Bear hug.
But they then get to thank these people who've supported their artwork because a lot of artwork now is sold online and you never get to meet the artist. Mm. If I sell an original painting, I try my best to hand deliver it to the door so that I can thank them because it's a lot of money that they're putting into you to buy. So I've said to all these, like at this exhibition, you're going to have friends and family who are going to be coming along. Yeah. hopefully if any of you have made sales and stuff, which I know a few of them have, their collectors can come along.
Yeah.
Or people who are just going to see the work for the first time on the night are going to see it and be like, who's that? Yeah. Then they're going to be, I've said, if you see someone looking at your work, you better go be over line. And say, that's mine, that.
Yeah.
Just be dead like, I done that. And just talk to them. Because I feel like, you said it before, where I do believe people will buy into a product if they know who the product's from, kind of thing, beforehand. So that's why I feel like this exhibition's really important. Because all these people who I've met, I went and had a cup of coffee with each one of them to sit and talk about everything first. And I just knew that they were all lovely. So I feel like anybody who comes to the exhibition is going to feel the same about them. And hopefully they might gain an extra 10, 20 collectors or even just people who are going to follow the career.
Yeah. Just a few followers even on their socials. Yeah. It's exposure. Do you know what I absolutely love about this is the thing that shows through. I always think every podcast or every conversation, there's something that shows through. You know, we come full circle back to the whole gratitude thing. You're showing a lot of gratitude, but how many people would go, I had to do it all on my own. I had to create my own space. I had to do my own. And yet you're creating this opportunity for other people. I think despite the, you know, sheer darkness that you've experienced in the past, that instead of just doing it for you, you're creating, you know, you're this beacon of light. You've got the biggest smile on your face 24/7. This other than sometimes when you can see your moody face with your, you know, this is me doing my art. The light and shade.
The photographs when I'm moody, that's me happy. That's I don't like smiling. But my head's dead big.
You just got smile bitch face.
It just go. I look like Shrek, especially with my skin out now. So that's why people have commented, like, why do you always look so fucking moody on your photos? I'm like, I'm buzzing. I just feel like.
You just can't tell me face.
It's better than this. I'm like Chandler Bing. If I smile, everything just like...
Don't know how to
people
smile.
People look at me and go, what the fuck? I either look like Chandler or Eddie Hall, the strongman. Like,
that's not a bad thing, is it? Everyone loves Eddie Hall. I just love, though, the fact that there is so much selflessness. You could be the type of person who goes, no balls to it. I had to put my, you know, heart and soul into it. I had to put my money behind me. I had to back me because no one else would. And that instead of doing that and using this date in May, which we're going to touch upon, to showcase your work again and go, actually, there's going to be me and I'm going to do 30 pieces of my own work. You've chosen six of yours and six other people.
Yeah.
Is there a significance to the number six?
No.
No.
Maybe you should have done seven. I feel like seven's more of a magic number, isn't it?
Well, it is six. It's six and you. It is seven. There you go.
One piece of art.
Obviously, I meant your own art. Go on then. Go on then. I wasn't where I was going, but if you want to take that bat on, that's absolutely fine.
I think the way it is, so my collection is going to be Jokers.
Yes.
So the Jokers have been, and you touched on before about Paul Smith.
Yeah.
He's a pivotal part of my career. I message him every now and again as big soppy messages because I'm always so grateful. The day that he bought my painting, I won't even say how much he paid for it, but he bought it. He asked how much it is. I told him how much it was and he just paid for it.
Yeah.
He didn't say, hey, I'm Paul Smith. Can I have a discount or can I have it for free and I'll put it on me?
Yeah.
Just bought it. That then propelled all kinds for me. Like, I got a whole new audience on the back of him.
Yeah.
Then recently, I've just sold a Joker painting to a new collector from Lebanon.
Wow.
A £10,000 painting. Huge painting. It was whilst I was doing that I was trying to create smaller pieces to see how his piece was going to come about. So I was painting my standard 36 by 36 size portraits of Jokers, which I used in his giant one.
Yep.
But I was building a collection whilst I was almost practicing.
How cool is that?
So, and then that's when I thought, right, hang on a minute. You've got the Jokers. You've got Paul Smith, everything that he's done for me. We've got the friendship with me and Hot Water Comedy and loads of the comedians who I've become friends with. Like Adam Rowe, he's bought work off me and stuff. Paul Blair and Binti, his brother, who, by the way, when we first went for the meeting at Blackstock, I knew Paul anyway. I felt like I'd seen his brother before, but I didn't recognise him. And he looked like he was in worky gear. So when we went in, I only spoke to Paul and I didn't ignore his brother, but I thought, this builder's not going to want to talk to me about artwork, you know, like while he's building or whatever. And then when I left, I was like,
Why was he there?
I swear I know him, you know. And I phoned Jen and she was like, that's his brother, you tit. I was like, oh, so I had to message Paul and I was like, do us a favour, just apologise to your brother for us. So the next time I see him, he let me know. but then we had, so we've got like, you know, a Joker collection, a comedy club, the connection with Paul. Then we've got the brothers. It all just come together. And then with the exhibition as well, each artist has said to me, do you want me to paint a Joker? And I'm like, no,
you paint whatever you want.
Anything. There's no guidelines or whatever you want to say. Just paint whatever
you want. No barriers. Just do what you want.
Just do what you want. Do what you're happier with. That's it.
Do you know what? I absolutely love that. And I think that shows through in terms of part of the reason why people are following you, love what you're doing, is that there's so, you're so selfless in it all. You could have used it as an opportunity to just showcase what you do. You're giving opportunities to other people. The significance of the date. Why the 23rd of May?
So the 23rd of May is going to be my 13th new birthday, is what we call it. So that's my clean and sober anniversary. So my mum and dad still get me a birthday card for every year.
Oh my God, I love it. So you're 13 this year. Oh God, you're getting into your teenagers. Oh. They must be shitting themselves.
Oh, honest to God, it's like every year, like they'll turn up with a card. Jen and Emmy will both get me a card. Emmy will write me a card. Happy birthday, Dad. 13. That's what it'll say this year. Was it last year? I think it might have been last year. There's a girl called Laura's Bakery. Yeah. She's a phenomenal baker. We had done something together a little bit time before. She had a fire in her house and
oh my God.
We'd done something, we're getting one of her prints framed up and stuff, just as a little gift. I didn't even know her, but it was just like, we're getting that frame for you. She turned up on my sober anniversary with a massive cake.
Oh.
I just cried. I was like, oh. So yeah, the 23rd of May is me clean and sober anniversary. It'll be 13 years and it just fits in. It's like, how do I celebrate the day? Well,
what
with everybody,
way to celebrate
with the people
it?
Who've been supporting me for the past 13 years can all turn up, and if they're not interested in art, the venue's got food. They've got music, do you know what I mean? They can go and do whatever they like.
I just think it's the perfect way to celebrate. There's so much that I plan to ask you, plan to discuss, the avenues it goes down. I know the time is just running away with us. So I'm going to ask you one question before I ask my question. One question is, can we do a round two?
Oh God, yeah.
Absolutely. 100%. There's so much that we haven't even touched upon. I feel like we've barely scratched the surface.
I told you I waffle on.
That's all right. So do I. Do you know what? Everyone will be grateful because they're used to me just sitting and talking nonstop. It's been lovely to just pass the baton and let you hear all of this about what you've achieved, what's next for you. Definite question. What's next? 23rd comes. Undoubtedly, it's going to be, you know, a roaring success. You're going to get more followers. You're exhibiting other people. You're creating opportunities for them. What's next for you?
What's next is, before that, I'm flying over to Dubai on the 20th, or on the 17th of April, to paint live at the Art Style Fest. Okay. Thousands of people will be at this event. I'm not going over. This isn't about sales or anything. They've given me a platform to go. I done it last year. Got an easel and I just painted live in front of everybody. I'm just going over to do that.
Love it.
We've got the exhibition on the 23rd of May. Thankfully, on the 24th of May, me and my wife will be jetting off because we've got to drive, but we're driving to Monaco for a few days.
Nice. This is an exclusive, isn't it?
Yes, it is an exclusive. We've got a Formula One collection being released at Monaco. I don't understand what they call whatever the docking station, wherever you dock your yacht or whatever, it's the main one.
Oh my God.
It's going to be on an exclusive yacht with only 65 people. And I've got three paintings that are going to be getting exhibited on the yacht. And one of them's Ayrton Senna, one of them's Michael Schumacher, and one of them is Lewis Hamilton as well.
Oh my God. Exciting things to come.
Yeah, and that just takes us up to May. And then after that, we are planning on another couple of things. I won't go into detail because it might not happen, but we're hoping for another exhibition, possibly in Dubai.
Nice.
As well, later on the year. It's got a little place in my heart over there.
You were there for over a year, weren't you?
Yeah, I loved it. I mean, there were things that I enjoyed and didn't enjoy, but they were, and now that I'm back here, I realise they were all my reasons, decisions that I made. Mm-hmm. Why I didn't get to enjoy myself as much as I did sometimes. So, but the place I still love. So yeah.
Big things coming.
A lot coming up this year.
So I could sit and talk to you all day, but I'm sure, well, we're in a studio, they're going to kick us out. So with that being said, I always finish on one question. And my question is, what is the one question no one ever asks you, but you wish they would? Or what is the one subject matter no one ever touches upon that you think should be touched upon? It's meant to make you do that, by the way.
Fuck me. We only got 6 minutes.
That's why I've asked you for a round two.
Subject matter. Do you know what? This might sound stupid, but I don't feel like, you know, when people say, you're all right, how are you? I don't feel like people mean it.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's where you're going with
it. That's absolutely cool
for
me.
I would prefer it if somebody actually stopped and was like, how are you? Like, genuinely, how are you feeling right now? Not like, just a
it's
genuine...
It's not a cursory hello and a how are you, yeah, waiting for the
typical
fan.
I walk into a room
fan
and I go, you're all right? And they go, yeah, how are you? I'm like, fuck off, I didn't mean that. I just meant, hiya. I didn't mean, how are you? I'm great, how are you? That always, it throws
you
me off.
You know I'm
going
to throw that question to you now and say, how are you?
Right at this moment, yeah. I'm good.
Yeah.
If he's asked me that a week ago, I'd have said I was in the fucking depths of hell.
Really?
Yeah, and I know we are short on time, but I kind of wanted to try and touch on this, like, so where people do think...
Everything's like, all sunshine and roses,
it's
unicorn
not all
thoughts.
The time. It's not. Like, I can be... I feel like I'm a good husband, I feel like I'm a good dad, I feel like I'm a good friend. I can also be an absolute twat to live with. Mm. Not because I'm an angry person or aggressive person, but I can just go vroom, at the drop of a hat and I could be there for half an hour or 4 or 5 days.
Really? What do you do when you're feeling that way? Is that where art comes in? Oh, really?
Eat.
Are you an emotional eater?
Yeah, like a punishing eater.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I'll just always like a 14-inch pizza and then loads of other stuff and then I'll feel bad about myself after it.
But you need to do that so that you can get through it and get over it. But today you're feeling good.
I feel great today. I've loved being here talking to you.
I appreciate that.
Don't know why, right? I don't know if it's because I obviously knew you were Scouse in the end, but when we first connected, I thought you were Irish.
Really?
Mm.
So my family are. Maybe that's just because I barely speak English. Maybe that's what it is.
But no, I've really, really enjoyed today. And yeah, I think this will light a little fire for me for the rest of the week as well.
I absolutely love that. Thank you so much for taking the time out. I appreciate it. Everyone should absolutely start following artist John Charles. He's got a documentary out there on YouTube. We're going to put this out on YouTube. Start following him, buy his art, and see you on the next one.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.